Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the June 24th, 2008 edition of Rubber Guard Radio. I am your host, KZ. Our first segment is brought to you by our sponsor, WrestleWarehouse.com. You can get Lucha Libre masks, wrestling DVDs, all kinds of different stuff, WWE swag and all that other fun stuff. And also, the other sponsor will be FogCityWrestling.com. Fog City will be debuting in a new building on July 5th in San Francisco at the Kezar Pavilion. You can get all information on that show at FogCityWrestling.com. Enough of the bullshit. I am on the line with one of my personal favorite pro wrestlers, Mr. Al Snow. How you doing, Al?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Oh, tremendous, tremendous. It's cooled off a lot up here in Northern California. Whew, man. Oh, we've been going through a heat wave, and hasn't been too pleasant. How's it out there in Lima, Ohio?
It's actually not too bad. It's been mostly in the 90s, but not real humid, so, you know, it's been pretty pleasant. As long as it doesn't get too humid, I don't mind. So.
Cool. Well, welcome to the show. I do have to go on the air and on the record. I will have to put Rob Feinstein over for hooking you up with me. Thank you, Rob. I know you're listening. you know, Rob's a good guy, you know. You do a favor for him, he does one for you, so.
That's right. Rob's been around the business for quite a while, so. Rob was actually very instrumental in when I first went to ECW the very first time. God, I can't remember the year, but it was before I had the second run, before I went 94. To WWE the first time. So, you know, that was Rob was instrumental in getting that done.
It was 1994. Rob was the promoter for the house show. It was at a high school, and you worked Sabu?
I think it might have been Taz. You know, I was Taz.
Right.
Taz tested tough numerous times. So.
Okay. Yeah. So it was Taz, and then you you showed up for double tables with Benoit.
I'd also had worked at the arena with a good friend of mine, Osamu Nishimura, and a couple other shows. I think I you know, it's hard to remember, and then. And then, of course, with Benoit.
Well, you brought up Mr. Nishimura. You know, the guy's beat cancer, and he's still doing this stuff at a high level.
Yeah, he's a terrific guy. You know, I've kind of lost touch with him over the years, but Osamu Nishimura is a very good friend, and, you know, I still consider him a very good friend, even though I haven't actually spoken to him in quite some time. And, you know, I was really worried about him and, you know, his health. When he had, you know, was battling cancer, because of, you know, God, you know, they don't want to hear that for anybody, especially a person you consider your friend. And, you know, but thank God he's fought back, and you know, it looks like he's doing better than ever. I mean, he's still in the ring performing and doing what he loves to do.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of Mr. Nishimura as an in-ring talent?
Well, you know, when I saw him, I mean, he was very, very young and very green, and they had sent him to the United States to put on weight and everything like that. And unfortunately, I haven't really gotten a chance to watch him much since then. I'm sure that he's probably only gotten, you know, he's probably only gotten just better and better since I saw him, and he was very good then. You know, we had some really good matches. So I'm sure he's probably even better now.
Well, the listeners that are listening, they know where you come from. We're not going to go, you know, from the beginning, you know, where you broke in, you know, the Andersons
sure.
did their thing and all that. So we're just going to pass over all that stuff.
Sure.
Give me a Jim Lancaster story on the road.
A Jim Lancaster story? God, there's tons of them. I mean, you know, you always had to keep on your toes with Jim. He was, you know, always thinking. And, you know, if you, by chance, we'd all always stop to eat. And by chance, if you were in there and you forgot your wallet or something, you know, he would make a big deal of it and make it seem like, you know, you were trying to skip out on the check when you were going out to your car to get your wallet. Just different ways to rib you, 100 different ways. His brother Rick was the easiest to rib because he would sell the most, especially when it came to anything remotely that seemed homosexual, and which was even funnier when you consider Rick was over 300 pounds and so was Jim, so it was like, you know, two giant homosexuals. So Jim would automatically, whenever we'd go into a restaurant, would start rubbing up on Rick and acting like, you know, it was his gay lover. And then, of course, Rick would deny it, and Jim would act like, you know, how it hurt his feelings, and he's going to start to cry and cause a huge scene in front of the entire restaurant, which would, you know, embarrass Rick even more. And then I even, you know, we had a friend, he was a black wrestler, and was on the road with us, and we'd go to, you know, some of these towns were incredibly uncomfortable with black people in the first place, and, you know, every time we'd go into a restaurant, you know, Jim would, excuse me, ma'am, do you serve black people here? You know, and I myself, you know, did that with Devon and Maven one time when we went up, we were in Canada, and every time we'd go into a restaurant, I'd, excuse me, miss, excuse me, do you serve black people here? And they'd all get really worried and start getting nervous, and, you know, Devon would go, ow, what are you doing? And I, you know, which would, of course, put it over even more. And I'd go, because they're Negroes. And Maven, you know, would get all, you know, would just start laughing. And the people would just get so upset and worked up. And I thought it was funny, you know, and so did Devon and Maven. So to get me back, we finally ended up in Nova Scotia the last night of the tour. And we were in Halifax. And we had rented a big SUV, we went in. Maven and Devon and I were still riding together, and Maven was driving the car, and we go to leave, and they have a like a gate, you know, in front of like a barrier. So I get out of the truck not thinking, with Devon in the back seat and Maven driving, and I'm not even considering it. I go to move the barrier. And the minute I go to move it, the security guy goes, oh, I got it. So as I'm walking back to the truck, I hear a click, click, and they lock the doors. And I'm like, oh, crap. So I jump on the running board and hang on to the luggage rack. So they drive right out of the building with me hanging inside of the car, and they drive right through the fans, who, of course, the fans are saying, hey, Al Snow, hey, not realizing I'm hanging on the outside of a car while it's moving, like a stunt person. And I thought, no big deal. You know, that once we get outside through the fans, they'll stop. No, they didn't. They drove on down to the end of the street and then turned the corner. I thought, well, they'll stop now. No, it continued to drive all around the downtown area of Halifax, Nova Scotia, with me beating on the door trying to get in. They wouldn't let me in. They were going to start driving out towards the airport, which if anybody's been to Halifax knows it's like a 20-minute ride, which I was not going to ride on the outside of the truck, hanging on the luggage rack for 20 minutes at 65 miles an hour. It wasn't going to happen. So I started screaming, help, police, Negroes are stealing my car, help, police. And after about two or three times of that, they immediately pulled over and unlocked the car and let me in. So, which was pretty funny. I mean, you know. And before anybody goes, well, I was racist or whatever, I'm the least racist person that there could possibly be on this earth. It was just something funny to do and get a reaction out of them. So
and after you broke in, you were doing the thing out in the Midwest, Ohio, Michigan, and whatnot.
Doing it all pretty much all over. I mean, not just Ohio and Michigan. You know, I would go into Kentucky and West Virginia and Virginia and Illinois and Pennsylvania and just wherever I could get booked. You know, I worked for a lot of territories, you know, that at the time were starting to fizzle away when I first got started.
So, how did you come across a gentleman whose career is paralleled with yours, Sabu? How did you run into him on the road? And
well, you know, I'd met Sabu a couple of times on different shows, with, you know, cause, with his uncle, and you know, our paths would cross. And in fact, I remember Sabu from when, you know, he wasn't even really smart to the business, you know, because his uncle refused to smarten him up. And he was always a, you know, he's always a good guy. Very, you know, people just don't realize just how great a guy he really is. But you know, he would be on the same show. Then he started being on the same shows. I remember I worked a show for an Azteca Hall. I think it's the first time I saw him actually wrestle in Michigan, where Malcolm Monroe, God rest his soul, had run a show. And I'd used, I think that was Rob Van Dam, and his partner at the time was a guy by the name of Dango, who was just as talented as Rob. And they had just, you know, it was like their first or second match, I think. And then I was running some shows in Lima at the time, and you know, brought them down to use them too, use Rob and Dango and Sabu himself, and you know, and then just kept bumping into each other, and we, you know, got to know each other very well.
Because Sabu is one of those. There was a handful of guys around that time, before you went into Smokey, where it was either you against Sabu or you against Benoit or Scorpio. There was just a handful of guys that, you know, that were just scraping a way to get, you know, with one of the bigger companies. And one match that has stuck in my mind forever, it's one of my favorite independent matches. It was filmed by Bob Barnett in Pomona, California, 9/11/94. Sabu, Al Snow, and Terry Funk in high school. And still, that match still stands the test of time. You may remember it because Terry Funk was going nuts in the parking lot, and the police were called.
Yeah. And he had to crawl underneath the van, and yeah, it was funny.
Yeah, that was good stuff. And I watched that match at least once a month. It still stands the test of time. What do you think of Terry as a worker?
But Terry Funk, I mean, God, you know, what hasn't been said? I mean, you know, he's a guy that
from a fan standpoint,
Terry Funk has the one thing that makes professional wrestling, and that is unpredictability. You know, you can't, if it gets to the point to where you can predict everything, and you can predict when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen, why it's going to happen, there's nothing fun about it. The point of professional wrestling is to never know what to expect. Because to be honest with you, to really do it properly, you really, when you walk out there, you don't know what to expect. Because you don't know what the fans are going to do. And it's all just completely impromptu. And there's nobody more impromptu than Terry Funk. I mean, you know, you just got to kind of go with whatever's going to happen. And, you know, and he's believable. You know, he goes out there, people believe he's nuts, and I mean, probably is.
But, yeah, a little bit.
You know, so many people in this business have, you know, emulated or copied aspects of Terry Funk and what he does and how he does it. And, you know, and I'm not just talking about, you know, guys that you might know. I'm talking, you know, like Harley Race and guys like that have taken things from Terry, you know, little things here and there, and utilized them in them and made them their own. And Terry Funk's just amazing, you know, and he just, you know, keeps going. I mean, don't fool yourself. I mean, the only reason that Terry Funk keeps going, it's not because he needs to, it's because he truly loves the business. I mean, he just absolutely loves the wrestling business. And it's hard. I've kind of come to realize, you know, when I always wondered why sometimes old-timers were always so bitter, you know, because the vast majority of them are pretty bitter. But the reason that they are is because, you know, it's so amazing to actually be in that ring and to do what you do, that when you get older and you realize that, you know, you can't get to do it anymore or do it quite at the level that you could. A lot of guys sometimes get a little, I think they inadvertently get a little jealous and a little bitter towards the guys that still can, because they so badly still want to be able to get in there and do it.
Well, the thing about Terry is that he's had many different careers where he's able to change himself and evolve, and that's his secret to his longevity. That, and he is unpredictable.
You're absolutely right.
On the marquee.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that he's changed and he's evolved, and you know he's the reason he's had those opportunities to change and evolve is because he's been able to change and evolve. He's not stayed static. You know, he's always been developing a new, always growing and you know and sometimes even acknowledging or accepting who and what he really is, you know, like when he was in WCW and he was, you know, talking about how he was middle-aged and crazy. You know, he wasn't trying to go out there and try and put it off like he was something he wasn't.
I have to agree. Terry was one of those guys as well that was the handful of guys that you could, you know, go out there and you would, like Scorpio and these other guys, where you would get booked with these guys. What do you have any stories of the military-based matches you had out here in California?
I remember that one that you were talking about with Sabu, and you know, I went through a long period of time there where I was booked a lot with Sabu, pretty much all over the country, and you know, we just had a chemistry, we clicked, and we complimented each other, and you know. And then involving Terry Funk in the match, you know, they were hoping to eventually, you know, build to some kind of three-way match, I think. And that would have been like a dream come true. I mean, that would have just been, you know, amazing to have gotten the chance to do that. And, you know, the military bases, I mean, it's hard for me to just pick one match
there
out.
There were so many of them. I mean, there were just so many.
Yeah, it's really tough. I mean, it's really tough. I hope so. I mean, I really have always tried every night to go out for 26 years. I've always tried, and you know, let's face it, sometimes I probably didn't even come close to the mark. But I've always tried to go out and make sure that, you know, the fans got their money's worth. You know, people can say whatever they want about my career, but I certainly have never not shirked working. And work, you know, because I just genuinely love to get in the ring and perform, and do everything I possibly can with whoever I am in that ring with at the time, regardless of, you know, their status or experience level or you know, age or. That makes no difference to me. If you know, I'm going to do everything I can that when somebody pays to see me and when they leave, that they feel like they, you know, they got their money's worth.
One of the matches that in this time period, 93-94, that stands out was the matches you had with Chris Candido. What are your feelings on the work that Candido did and your chemistry with him?
You know, Chris was an amazingly talented, you know, professional wrestler, and you know, it was just such a joy to work with him in the ring because, you know, we have a saying in wrestling, and we used to anyways, is that, you know, there are two types of matches, and the one was that you'd go out and you'd work with a guy. And it was like a night off, you know. You could go out there, and you know, the guy would dance with you, and it really is. It's like a dance, you know. He can just, you could go out there, and you turn right, he turns right. You turn left, he turns left. You know, you step forward, he steps back. You step back, he steps forward. I mean, it just takes a, you know, just one little word from either one of you, and the other guy just goes. Boom, right there, and those are nights off. I mean, you don't feel the next day or even later that night, you don't feel tired, you don't feel physically hurt, you actually feel energized. And you can't wait to do it the next night after that. It's, you know, it's the greatest high in the world. And then there are guys that you get in the ring with, you know, it's like dancing with a Jeep. You know, you just can't seem to get them to, you know, they're on their own page. And it's like, it literally is like pulling teeth or like having your teeth pulled. And, man, you know, it unfortunately these days it's more about pulling teeth than it is about the nights off. And the nights off, every time you stepped in the ring with, you know, Chris Candido was like a night off. I mean, it was so much fun because one minute you'd be out there and you'd be, you know, wrestling a serious wrestling match, and then all of a sudden you could throw in, you know, some ridiculous ha-ha, funny, make the people laugh for a second spot, and then go right back to, you know, blood and guts wrestling, and then right back to, you know, making them laugh for a second. It was so simple and so easy to do that. And, you know, Chris was so, he was, how can I say, he honestly was so full of life. He had his demons, that's for sure, but he was so full of life, and he truly loved, absolutely madly loved the business, and truly, you could see he was at his happiest when he was at a wrestling show, and absolutely at his happiest when he was in a wrestling match. You know, I don't know if a lot of people know his grandfather, you know, wrestled, and you know, that's where Chris caught the bug. He was. It's such a shame because he was such a good friend. You know, I went to his funeral and just cried because it was such a loss. You know, you'd walk into the building and you'd see Chris Candido and, you know, just light up because you just knew, you know, no matter what, it was going to be, you know, it was going to be good. You know, you're going to have fun somehow, some way. You're going to have a good time. So
yeah, I put Chris in the same category as you. Where it's more than a job. You guys go out there and you it's enjoyable. You guys, and you're not just telling the fans a story. You're telling the boys in the back a story as well.
Oh yeah. Sometimes we were telling ourselves a story too.
Yeah, sure. That's, you know, that's I put you in the same category as well because, you know, you see Al Snow on the marquee. You see Candido on the marquee. You know damn well you're going to get a good match. You know it's not going to be crap. You know, and it's not going to be the garbage that you see on TV. You know, it's a shame that Candido passed because I'll tell you, he would have had the highest enrollment in the Chris Candido Wrestling Academy. I could tell you that much.
Yeah,
he finally decided to hang it up.
Chris was was such a talented kid that I think he was, you know, probably one of the modern age, you know, greats. I think he would have been, especially if he could have kept his own. Personal demons under control, and I think he was getting them under control, and I think he was on his right track. I think, you know, years to come, like everybody talks about Terry Funk and, you know, Harley Race and, you know, this guy and that guy, I think, you know, in years to come, I think people would talk about, you know, Chris Candido in the same way, which I think would thrill him more than anything else.
Yeah, exactly.
So, exactly. It's a shame. It really is. And not just for the wrestling business, but in general, that people, you know, that you know, he had to pass away so young, that, you know, people, you know, lose such a good guy. It's really sad.
And he was a good guy outside of the ring. You know, he'd give his shirt.
Yeah, and that's what I mean is that, you know, that's what I mean by, you know, and like Sabu, I mean, you know, people don't realize, like Sabu, you know, if he called you up and he said, hey, you know, I got this guy, he's booking a show, and, you know, you want to come and work on it, and so on and so forth, and you go, okay, yeah, sure, no problem. You get there, and the guy then wouldn't pay you. Well, then Sabu would take money out of his own pocket and make sure that you got paid because he put his, you know, he gave his word. You know, he's the one that got you booked, so he felt responsible, you know. And Chris, Chris was like the head of the Island of the Misfit Toys. I mean, he, you know, went out of his way to help, you know, Balls Mahoney and, you know, Handsome Jimmy Shoulders and, you know, Paul E. Tons of guys. You know, so it's not just the wrestling world's loss, but the world's loss that, you know, a guy like, you know, Chris Candido is no longer in it.
Another guy that was floating around at this time was D'Lo Brown.
Yes. D'Lo spent a little time spent time with me
D'Lo
at my school.
D'Lo just got re-signed. Did you see that? He just got re-signed by
by
New York.
Good for him. Yeah, good for him.
Well, kinda. I've really gotten into his All Japan and New Japan stuff. He's really picked it up to a new level, and it's gonna be interesting to see what not even what he can do, but what he will be allowed to do up there.
Well, hold on now. That's a big misnomer or myth of what he'll be allowed to do. You know, they don't keep you from doing things. You know, I can honestly say I believed it too at one time, and it's asinine to think this way. And that is that, you know, Vince does not want everybody to get as much heat as possible or to get over as much as possible. That's just, it's insane. The more a person gets over and the more heat a person gets, the more Vince can now do things with, the more money he can make. And if not for money, more what really drives him is just his passion for the wrestling business. The more he can now, you know, how many people out there think that he really, Vince McMahon, does not want to go back to the late 80s when he was running A, B, and C towns every single night of the week? How many people think that he does not want to do that? But in order to be able to do that, he has to have as many guys as possible on that roster get as much heat as possible, if they're heels, and get over as much as they possibly can, not just two or three or four guys, but every guy. He wants everybody to do that. Now, granted, I mean, I'm not naive. I'm not stupid. There are politics that are plays involved in there. But you got to understand what D'Lo did in New Japan, or I forget where you said he worked, but what he did there worked there. Their psychology is different. The reason their psychology is different is because their audience is different. The national sport in Japan is judo. That means that they play judo in as part of phys ed training in high school. Like you play basketball or baseball or football in high school and phys ed, they do it in Japan in high school. So people have a physical relationship with what happens in the ring as opposed to what happens here in the United States. People don't have a physical relationship to what happens in the ring. So the psychology in Japan is based differently than what it is here in the United States. And they may be bringing D'Lo in. Think of it like a picture puzzle. And he's a particular piece that they're trying to fit in to make a particular picture. If D'Lo doesn't come in and do what particular business they need him to have done, that's not them holding back. It's that D'Lo's not doing that business. Now, you have to understand that business is all important. And this is something that's kind of getting lost in wrestling. I'll ask you, because, you know, I assume you want D'Lo to go in there and have the best match you can possibly have, don't you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That would be great. But the problem is everybody does not know all the quote-unquote smart marks out there, which is an oxymoronic term, because how can you be marked for something if you're smart to it? The mark is somebody that's being lied to and being conned, but apparently he's smart to it at the same time. It's not possible. it's like military intelligence. Just doesn't work. Or an honest politician. They just, you know, they don't go together. It costs $30,000 for 30 seconds on Raw. Okay? 30 seconds of airtime costs $30,000. They give D'Lo a six-minute match. That's $360,000 that Vince McMahon has just invested into D'Lo, not counting rent for the arena, all the lights, the cameras, the rigs, that stage, the people that work in the studio, the truck, the satellite time. I mean, I could go down the list. Do you think Vince wants him to go out there and have the best match on the show, or do you think Vince wants him to go out there and do whatever business he needs that will now sell more than $360,000 worth of tickets?
No. Uh-uh.
Which do you think it is?
He wants to sell the tickets. It's simple.
Yeah, because to pay for all those semis you see in the parking lot, all those other wrestlers that you want to watch, and all the TV time, et cetera, every single person that gets put on that TV show has to sell more tickets than what has been invested in him. If he does not, then you're not doing business. And if you're not doing business, then no matter how great the match was, what's the matter? Let's say D'Lo has a great match. He has a match in a building that seats 5,000 people, and there are 3,000 people there. He has the greatest match that you've ever seen in the history of wrestling. No doubt about it. I mean, Jesus could walk on water, and it still wouldn't be as astounding as the match you just saw D'Lo have. Okay? Next month, you ran that same building, but you had 1,500 people instead of 3,000. How great was the match?
Didn't draw, so I guess it's not.
Apparently it's not now, is it? Everybody's seen WrestleMania 3, correct?
Yes, sir.
Who was the greatest worker? Who were the greatest workers on the show?
Hogan and Andre.
Ray, your answer is correct. Because 93,000 people paid to see Hogan and Andre. Not the answer that first comes to your mind, because I'm sure it did and you didn't say it, which was Savage and Steamboat. Savage and Steamboat were not the best workers on the card because 93,000 people did not pay to see Savage and Steamboat. 93 people paid to see Hogan and Andre.
Well, there was a reason that they had Hogan and Andre on the Piper's Pit as opposed to Steamboat and Savage on the Piper's Pit.
Because Hogan and Andre would draw 93,000 people. Savage and Steamboat at that time would not. And that's not a disparagement on Savage and Steamboat. It's an example to help wrestling fans understand what it is that wrestlers are really supposed to be trying to do. Unfortunately, wrestlers nowadays are out there trying to have the best match on the show and not have the match that sells the most tickets. Best match on the show, probably Savage and Steamboat. Match that sold the most tickets, therefore really the best match on the show, Andre and Hogan.
There you go. Well, let's bring up a name from your past. Bruiser Bedlam. Now,
oh, Johnny K-9. Yes, I love him. Huh?
He is so scary looking.
Ah, I love them. I love Bruiser Bedlam.
Any road stories with the Bruiser?
Oh, for tons of them, but probably most of them would probably get him thrown in jail someplace, some point here in North America. I'm sure. He's Johnny K-9. I mean, he's Bruiser Bedlam. You know, the man named his penis Bobo, and would have Bobo do tricks, like have Bobo smoke a cigarette and things like that. It was, I can't say enough about it. He's a one of a kind. He's a one in a million, and, thank God. But at the same time,
exactly.
I can't, let me tell you something. I'm thrilled every day I got the chance to meet, Bruiser Bedlam. He's tremendous.
Well, I'm going through your history here, and you decided to start working for Jim Cornette in Smoky Mountain, and you started to team with a young Glenn Jacobs, Kane.
Yeah.
Now,
mm-hmm.
Did you, in your honest opinion, feel that Kane would be a star, that Glenn would be a star?
Oh, I think that, he had all the tools and the attributes. And, before he was Kane, when he was the fake Big Daddy Cool, the fake Diesel, that was where he really got it. That was where he really turned his career around. I mean, that was where he really came into his own. And, I think that's what really helped him become Kane, or have an understanding. The thing about being a professional wrestler is that it takes years and a lot of experience, good and bad, to really understand what it is that you're trying to do out there. And, he had his run as Isaac Yankum, but it was a learning experience for him. And I think that when he had that chance as a fake Diesel, that was where he really took off. And, when I came in, I totally, when I think back about it, and I think back about it with the experience I had and my understanding that I have now, I mean, I completely screwed up that that chance that I had with Glenn. I mean, we were a great team, but they brought me in. Cornette brought me in to replace Eddie Gilbert. Eddie had taken off and went to Puerto Rico, and the deal was supposed to be that, you know, I would be the heater. I'd be the guy that would run his mouth and, you know, be able to wrestle, but, you know, make everybody want to see him get his ass kicked. And then, you know, Glenn would be the guy that would step in and stop. And, you know, the fans would have that idea in their head that, boy, if it hadn't been for, you know, the big monster, you know, the babyface would eventually get his hands on me. And, you know, we did great as far as, you know, a team and stuff. The problem was I did too much stuff. I wrestled too much. I didn't understand that by doing less, I'd have gotten more heat. I'd have been more of a draw as a heel and gotten more heat as a heel, and then thus sold more tickets. I was still out there trying to have, you know, the best match on the card. And we had some really great matches with, you know, Ricky and Robert and, you know, Tracy Smothers and Dirty White Boy and you know, I can go on down with the Armstrongs. We had a lot of really great matches. But the problem is that wasn't what I was there for. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, nobody smart me up to it. You know, I wish Jimmy had pulled me aside and said, hey, stupid, do it this way. Because it would have gotten so much more heat, which would have then, you know, maybe I could have helped, you know, up the territory even more. And, you know, looking back now, I completely understand that.
Now, so. whose idea was it for you and Glenn to do the promos with the wigs about the Rocky Express?
All the promos and stuff were my idea. I mean, you know, I would set driving because, you know, you
really?
Remember I drove from Lima, Ohio to Tennessee every week, and, God, that was brutal, you know. And I would sit in the car and I would try to come up with, you know, promos, just different ways, you know, different promos, different things. You know, some of the really good stuff, the funny stuff, or I should say, or very entertaining stuff, a lot of people didn't get to see because every week we had to do, towns, you know, we had to do sitting in there and we'd do 10 or 12, you know, 30-second, 45-second promos for the towns. And it was my, you know, I knew all the boys were watching, so I did everything I could to entertain myself and entertain the boys, too. And, you know, I didn't want to just do the same Pat promo each time I did a promo for a different town. So every time I did a different town, I did a completely different promo. Even if I were, you know, we had one run where we were working with the Armstrongs, and I'd constantly be trying to do, you know, a brand new promo for every town. And I'd always try to make Glenn laugh under his mask. And see if I could, you know, I knew it was a good one if I could make him start to lose, you know, lose his composure because he did everything he could to keep his composure. So, like even one time, you know, when Bob Armstrong was wearing the mask and I swore up and down that, you know, the Armstrongs were an army of thieves and, you know, Bob were, you know, they actually wore different masks in their other job, which was robbing convenience stores. And I, much like Raising in Arizona, you know, bent down and put pantyhose over my head that still had both legs on it and continued to cut the promo swinging the pantyhose around like big rabbit ears, you know, back and forth, trying to get Glenn to lose it underneath his mask. So, you know, and I just, you know, the great thing about, you know, wrestling is that, you know, you don't have any constraints put on you. If it's done properly, you know, you don't have constraints put on you. You're told, you know, go out there and get these points across, and then you're free to do it however you want to do it. You know, they would, you know, occasionally suggestions would be made, but then the rest was just left up to you know, me. So, you know, I came up with all kinds of, you know, I was supposed to be a smart-ass chicken shit heel, and so that gave me freedom to just, you know, go out there and pretty much say whatever I wanted.
You've had many, many memorable promos, many memorable vignettes. My personal favorite vignette that I've seen of yours was when you were in the bar. This was a WWF promo. It was a little after you came in for your run in 98. and you were in the bar with Head, and Head wanted to drive home, and Head fell off the bar stool, and you said, "Friends don't let Heads drive drunk." That's my personal favorite vignette. What's your personal favorite vignette that you've done?
Oh, gosh, that's hard to say. I mean, you got to think, I was on, especially just in WWF alone, I was on TV back when we worked both Raw, SmackDown, and, you know, I was on Raw, SmackDown, and Heat, and then Velocity. I was on every one of those shows every single week doing something for a couple of years, you know, where I was just on everything. You know, and not always, you know, always being the big, you know, the center of attention, but I was always on there doing something, doing some kind of business. And, you know, I'm trying to think. I think, you know, one of the things, because I think some of the best stuff I ever did outside of the ring, vignette-wise, was with Steve Blackman. And somebody reminded me of this, and I had forgotten it. But then when they reminded me, I thought, yeah, my God, that was tremendous. That was, I really loved that. And that was, I was reading a poem to Steve Blackman. And as I was reading the poem, that was when he held the hardcore belt and had that 24/7 rule. And guys were attacking him. And I was oblivious and complaining to him. It was because he didn't listen to me. And he's, you know, killing people left and right as they're jumping out of the woodwork, trying to beat him for the hardcore title. And then finally I just turned to him and go, "See, this is exactly what I'm talking about. You never heard a word I said." And they just stormed off. And it was, you know, it was really a lot of fun.
Yeah, some of that stuff was just unbelievable. Like when you first came back in 98, the trying to get the meeting with Vince, and then coming in the different disguises, and that stuff was brilliant. Who assisted in getting? I hate using the word writing, but who helped write those vignettes and promos?
They didn't really write vignettes or promos, but like you said, assist, I guess you could say, was like Russo was very instrumental in you know, coming up with situations or things that, you know, okay, here's what you're going to do, and now, you know, and then I pretty much, you know, he'd give me some ideas, and then I'd do the rest, you know. He came to me and, you know, we were in Florida. I'll never forget, we were in Tampa, Florida, you know, and I would show up at the building, and, you know, he's like, yeah, you need to have a eulogy, and basically a funeral for Pierre the Deerhead, you know, and the day of, you know, just walks up and says that, and it's like, what? You know, so I got to go around and get stuff and gather, you know, gather up ideas and ways that I can, you know, and I go out there and I have a funeral for a Deerhead, you know. And Brian Gewirtz, when we were doing the Blackman stuff, he and I would talk and we'd come up with different ways, you know, I'd give him ideas and stuff like that. And then he would, you know, say, how about this or how about that? And, you know, we almost had our own little show within a show. It was like the Al and Steve show back during that time. And, you know, it was so much fun because, you know, Steve was the perfect straight man. Because sometimes I don't think he really got it sometimes. I mean, you know, we always laugh because, you know, he would, for legitimately, we'd be in the car, and I'd be explaining what was going to happen, and he'd go, "Well, why wouldn't I just, you know, knock the guy out?" I'm like, "Well, because, you know, it's fake. I mean, because we're not going to do that, you know. That wouldn't be funny. It'd be more funny to watch you get upset." "Well, I don't get it." "Well, just trust me, just stay here, you know." Like when we went to do the, where he was doing stand-up routine at the old folks' home, and you know, he's reading them, and the first time he reads the jokes, he's like, "These jokes were horrible." It's like, you know, it's like, that's the idea. You're not supposed to be good. And he just didn't seem to get it at first that, you know, that was the point, is that he was supposed to be bad, that, you know, that they were supposed to be really dry, which made it even funnier.
Okay. A couple weeks ago, I completed the 2008 shoot interview you did with RF Video, and you said that you were not happy with the outcome from King of the Ring 98, your match. Now, I love the finish. I loved it. It was brilliant. Putting the head on the head and shoulders. It was brilliant from a comedic standpoint, but it was bad for business at that time for you.
Yeah, it was bad business, and I should have known better.
Who booked the finish?
Brian Christopher and Jerry Lawler had made the suggestion or whatever, and I foolishly agreed to it. You know, it was the wrong thing to do. I mean, it really was not the right thing to do. And I didn't work that match correctly either. I mean, I should have been working that match like I was trying to tag the head, you know, like it was really my partner to really get the gimmick across, and which I can do and could do, but I just didn't do that night because I just didn't have the proper understanding. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, it gave the wrong. You only get one chance to make a first impression, really paint a certain picture, and that hurt me. That wasn't smart. I mean, it was, you know, funny, and you know, it was very very humor.
Was,
yeah, it was great. It was great, but at the same time, it was the wrong thing to do, business wise.
Double-edged sword,
just, just it was not the right thing to do. It's like, you know, like back again to the best match on the card. I mean, I tell guys this all the time. You know, you get a dark match with, you know, and they want to take a look at you. So, you know, they book you with Funaki, which is, this is no disparagement against Funaki. I always have to say this because I don't want to throw anybody, you know, have anybody go around and, oh, wow, you know, burying everybody. I don't bury anybody. I honestly don't. I want everybody to succeed. I genuinely don't care, you know, who does. But somebody doing better does not make me do worse, and somebody doing worse doesn't make me do better. So I you know, I sincerely, whenever somebody succeeds, I go, I'm very happy for them. So, you know, that being said, because I don't want anybody to try and take out of context what I'm saying, you know, people book, you know, we all know how Funaki is booked. Well, when a guy shows up and they book against Funaki, and you're thinking when you go out there, I'm going to have the best match on the show. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to do everything I can to have the best match on your show. Well, that's great. Okay? But, you know, you want to really, the ultimately what you want to do is you want to work, you know, on top. You want to be the heavyweight champion. So when you go out there the first night and you're working with Funaki and you're going out there and having that match that, you know, it's the best match on the show, have you either, one, shown everybody that now you're on Funaki's level, or two, and had the best match on the show, or two, have you really went out there and did what you're supposed to do, which is look like you could be a contender for the heavyweight title? Because let's face facts. You know, if Triple H or even John Cena were to go work with Funaki, they'd make Funaki look pretty good, but they'd still look like they were the world heavyweight champion working with Funaki. They'd look like they were on the top of the food chain and that Funaki was on the bottom. And again, that's not putting Funaki down. That's how they book him. So you go out there and you have the best match on the show. You blow the roof off the place. But now you look like you aren't, you know, Funaki looks as good as you and you look as good as Funaki, which means that you don't look as good as John Cena or Triple H. So now are you ever going to get that chance to work with John Cena or Triple H? Probably not. You know, and if you do, it's only because you've now smartened up and you've now done everything you can to repair the very mistake you made, which was the mistake I made by when I went back, allowing them to put the head and shoulders bottle in the head. That was dumb. And it was my own fault. I should have known better.
Well, you mentioned Funaki and guys that come in for tryouts or whatever, and they look up on the board and they see, oh, shit, I'm working with Funaki. You know,
that's great. He's a hell of a hand.
He's the Brooklyn Brawler now.
Yeah,
back
but
the
and
day,
there was nothing
you know,
wrong with.
You know?
There's no disrespect with being the Brooklyn Brawler of the day. Before Brooklyn Brawler was a Johnny Rods, and the reason that those guys are there is because they take a look at you and they go, well, if this guy can't have a good match with Funaki, and meaning look like what he needs to look like and do the business he can do, because Funaki's going to do whatever he can to help you. You can't do that. Then how the hell do they expect that you're going to be able to do it with anybody else? You know, and the same with Brooklyn Brawler. If you can't go out there and look like what you're supposed to look like and do the business you're supposed to do with Brooklyn Brawler, brother, then we ain't going to invest $360,000 giving you a six-minute match on TV. And the same with Johnny Rods and on down the list. You know, that they're not looking to see if you're going to have the best match on the show. They're looking to see if you can look like a star. They're looking, they're trying to see if you're going to go out there and you're going to look like a future heavyweight champion, or you're going to go out there and look like you're now on Funaki's level. Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. Makes complete sense. And the reason I bring the point up again is a friend of mine in 98, he had a dark match up here in San Jose, and it was a tryout. He was on the board against Funaki, and, you know, he went out. It was a decent match. And then afterwards, you know, we were driving home, and, you know, and I asked him, I said, Mikey, you know, what's going on here? You know, what happened? You know, I'm all... You know, you could have, you know, done so much better, you know, had a better match. They just didn't click or something. And he said, well, I wanted to go out there, you know, and try to knock their socks off. I said, brother, it's a dark match. It's a tryout. It's a tryout. You're supposed to show them what you can do, but not overstep your bounds.
No.
Get a good idea.
It's a tryout. It's a tryout. And that means
right.
that they want to see if you look like a star, not what you can do. They don't give two shits what you can do. They don't care what you can do or can't do. Can you look like a star that will sell tickets? That's what they care about. And if you can't, if you don't impress them and they go, holy, you know, this guy's not a very good wrestler, but wrestlers don't make money. Workers make money. And if they go, wow, this guy's not a very good wrestler, but god damn, this guy, he has got it. He's a star. We can make money with him. Well, then guess what? What's going to happen? You're going to get hired. You go out there and show them you're a great wrestler and that you can have a really good match, you're probably not going to get hired. And that's the mistake that, you know, that was the mistake like I made that night. Your friend made the same mistake. It's not about having that good match. Showing them what you can do. They don't care what you can do. And to be honest with you, they shouldn't, because, you know, do you know the proper way to put a hammer lock on? Probably not. And guess what? 99% of the audience doesn't either. They probably not even had a hammer lock put on them, unless, of course, they've been involved in a domestic dispute that's allowed the police to be called. But otherwise, they probably never had a hammer lock put on them, and they probably never put a hammer lock on somebody. And since that's the case, they don't know when you're doing it right and when you're doing it wrong. All they know is that you did it at the right time, for the right reason, to get them to buy into what you're selling so that then they can believe even more, so that then they will pop, truly pop, have an emotional response at the end that will make them pay to see you again. And if you can't do that, then your opportunities, your chances to get $360,000 for a six-minute match or $60,000 for a one-minute promo are going to be nil, because it costs so much for them to give you that chance and that opportunity.
I'm going through these results, and I've gotten to where you were teaming with Marty. What did you think of Marty as a teammate?
Marty was great. Marty was very, very talented, incredibly talented guy. You know, Marty had a lot of demons, but the real mistake was that we were on two separate pages. You know, Marty didn't want to, you know, do the gimmick kind of the way I had understood it. And, you know, I took it and ran with it and, you know, made it as I thought we were supposed to be, kind of goofy and, you know, over the top. And you know, in both of our defense, Marty and I's defense, you know, nothing is older than yesterday's news. And nothing tells you that it's yesterday's news faster than to put new in front of it. You can put new in front of anything, and it's pretty much, you know, there are exceptions to the rule, but that's pretty much the nail in the coffin right there, you know. but it made it worse when, you know, Marty had one thing and I had another, and that was probably also due to probably my own inexperience again, or not quite thoroughly understanding what I really needed to understand.
at that time when you guys were teaming, there were so many great teams. You had Owen and the Bulldog who were the champs. Doug Furness and Phil LaFon. I don't think that they got the proper due by American fans. What do you think of Doug and Phil as a team and outside of the ring?
Oh, they were both great guys, inside and outside the ring. You know, Doug, you know, is practically a saint. You know, Phil was a great guy too. Really good. Both of them really good people outside of the ring. And you know, they again, you know, they spent a lot of time in Japan. And I don't think they were, like you said, they were quite given their due at that time. But again, they had a completely different mindset in how they approached things. And they had the tools. They were very capable physically and talented wise. It's just that I don't think it was they just want to literally, and I don't know how else to explain it, because I've tried to explain it to people, but you know, booking or whatever, a territory and stuff like that, it literally is like, you know, putting together a picture puzzle, and you don't have the lid with the picture on the box. And so you got a general idea of the picture you want to do. The problem is the picture is constantly changing and evolving all at the same time. Not to mention, while you're trying to put the picture together, you don't have any edge pieces either to kind of give you an outline of what you want. So you just pick and choose, and you know, you try, and you really, it comes down to, you know, it being a matter of this piece of the puzzle, Phil and Doug, doing the exact business that you imagined in your mind, coming across, feeling a certain way, giving that certain impression, so that they can continue to be that piece of the puzzle that fits, so that you can end up making that ultimately that picture that you're really trying to make. And I don't think they ever quite did it. Do you know what I mean? And at the same time, I think sometimes too, Jim Ross saw something in people sometimes, and then they would get there, and I don't think Vince quite saw it, because Vince doesn't see you until you're working for him. He don't watch nothing else, and he don't watch tapes. He don't watch it. He watches you in his ring, and if you don't match up with his vision, then, you know, and he don't quite get you or get what you're doing, then, you know, then you've got to kind of reinvent yourself. And if you don't reinvent yourself, then, you know, you're not going to continue to get those opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were leaps and bounds above, you know, pretty much anything that was on TV, with the exception of you and Marty and the Body Donnas. They were just, you know, any combination of the three teams, you knew you were going to get something good. I'm really surprised that they weren't really pushed, or actually, I think that maybe turning them heel and putting them with Cornette would have worked for them.
That's possible.
Do you think that would have clicked, maybe?
It might have, yeah, if Cornette would have given them direction, and, you know, and they could have gotten and understood how to do what it was that, you know, Vince was trying to get them to do at that time, you know, maybe it would have. I don't know. You know, like I said, there are a lot of factors that play into it. A lot of it is, you know, the wrestlers' mistakes. A lot of it is also Vince's perception. And then it's a lot of the other wrestlers creating a perception for Vince, you know, leading his perception of you too, you know, because let's not underplay the politics of it all either. But, you know, ultimately, the one thing I have learned is that once you step in between the ropes, it's solely your responsibility to accomplish whatever business needs to be done on that ring to that night, and get it done the way that it's, you know, thought of, and nobody can do anything to really help you once you step through the ropes. And honestly, it comes right down to it, nobody can really do anything to really hinder you either. I mean, yeah, they can lay out on you and dead weight you and not really put you over, but, you know, to be honest with you, you can pretty much get yourself over no matter what. I mean, you can see guys that do it all the time. irregardless of what politics have been played or what games guys play with each other. You can still see guys get themselves over or still get their heat. And, you know, keep in mind that there are always there's never just a wrestling match put on. It's never done that way. They'd always have to conduct one of three forms of business. You know, you either got to go out there and make the audience believe in you, or you got to go out there as a heel and get heat, or you got to go out there as a baby face and get over. You put a baby face over so that eventually you can have that baby face help another heel get heat, so that you can put more heat on that heel so that he can help another baby face get over stronger. So you can get that baby face over stronger so that he can help put more heat on another heel, so that you can eventually have that heel pay that heat off by putting another baby face over even stronger than that. There are no ifs, ands, or buts. There is nothing else done in wrestling other than those three things. It's never done just for unless they'll have a match. Every time you go to the ring, whether it's a house show, a spot show, or a TV show, it's done to do one of those three pieces of business. No doubt about it. And if you don't do those three pieces of business, guess what? You're probably not going to get an opportunity to do many more of them.
Pretty cut and dry, kids.
It is. I mean, you know, everybody would like to believe it's something else, or, oh, I did something wrong, or I have heat for this person or that person. And you got to understand, the wrestling business is not a verbal business. You know, it's not like they talk to you and they explain all this to you. They never have and they never will. You got to know in yourself what it is that you're supposed to be going out there and trying to do for business to sell tickets. And if you don't, well, guess what? You're going to wander, you're going to come back, and they're just going to say thank you, and you're going to be backstage wandering around for the next 2 or 3 months, not understanding or not knowing why you're no longer on TV, and they're not going to tell you. You're going to think you had the best match on the show, but yet you're not working anymore, and you're going to be thinking that, oh, they're trying to hold me back, they're trying to hold me down, or you know, and the fans will be telling you that you're underutilized. Brother, every time you go to the ring, you're being utilized. How could you not be utilized? So how could you ever be underutilized? And take it from somebody who used to get the underutilized award every year to where they were almost going to make it the Al Snow Memorial Award. I can tell you better than anybody else. That's insane. They never underutilize anybody. They try to utilize everybody to some degree, some way, so they can make money. Anyway.
Wow. There you go. Well, we're gonna go back to your second run in ECW.
Yes.
As far as the stuff you did on TV and whatnot, how instrumental was Paul E? Did he just say, "This is the direction," and you ran with it?
No.
Or
here's exactly what happened. I tried to quit WWE at the time because I was so frustrated. Bruce Pritchard rolled over my contract to kind of teach me a lesson, from what I understand. And I knew at that point in time that I had to get out of there, because of, you know, at the time I didn't realize, but they were my own mistakes. I had to get out of there and go someplace else to get myself over. I had to get myself over to where, you know, either Paulie would pay to keep me, Vince would pay to get me back, or Eric Bischoff would pay to take me away. So, you know, luckily Chris Candido, God bless him, was, you know, involved with Paul E at the time and talked Paul E, I think, you know, I'm assuming, into going to Vince and talking to Vince and getting me put on loan, basically, because I was still under contract, to ECW. And I went there with the complete idea that I was going to get myself over. I had to. And I tried everything, and finally one night, to the grace of God, I found a styrofoam head in the back, and, you know, I won't bore everybody with the details, but, you know, I started carrying it in the ring and talking to it, and it started getting over. And at the time, when I first started carrying it, you know, the only thing Paulie would tell me is, I hate your manager. But he never stopped me from doing it. And then one night, he finally came to me and goes, "You're going to be the next cult babyface." And I'm like, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. And, you know, it was the next night I was supposed to do something with Sandman at the ECW Arena to, you know, I guess get a rub from Sandman. And I ended up wrestling Paul Diamond, and Paul gave me a gourd buster, dislocated my shoulder, which was actually very fortuitous because I was out for like 2 weeks and I couldn't wrestle. And again, thanks to Chris Candido, I really believe Chris talked because I know, you know, even Taz had mentioned that they had the production meeting that day for the November to Remember pay-per-view, and that Chris had put in there for me to do a promo vignette backstage with the head. And that was where it really took off, was that was what really got it over, was that initial pre-tape of me in the back in the locker room screaming and arguing with the head while there were other people just sitting around acting like, you know, everything else was normal, but the only thing that was crazy was me talking to a plastic head and arguing with it. And thank God that it was, that, you know, that that's all it was just a vignette, and that I didn't get to wrestle, because if I'd have gotten to wrestle, I'd have probably screwed it up and wouldn't have gotten over near like I did by just simply doing the vignettes. Because the vignettes got me over more than anything else.
That vignette was brilliant. That it was just brilliant, where the head's telling you, you know, about you being hurt and shouldn't have told him you were hurt and all. Oh, that's just amazing. Where you took an inanimate object and made it an actual character. And I'll be honest, before that, I enjoyed your work, okay? But then that promo, I fell in love. And no, I'm straight, by the way. I fell in love with you and the character, and then it was just on. And, you know, still, some of the fondest memories were from that ECW run. And it's just amazing. And it's not like it came from, you know, a booking meeting or some Hollywood writer's idea. It just happened. That's what's missing now.
That's the best stuff in wrestling. Yeah, that's the best stuff in wrestling, is that it just, you know, the magic of wrestling is that it really, it just happens. I mean, nobody told me. They just said, hey, you got a promo with the head. And I just went, okay. And, you know, and then you just do it. I mean, it's just like Steve Austin, or, you know, I can go on down the list of guys that have really made, you know, Rock was not planned. You know, that just happened. Steve Austin was not planned. It's those guys, you know, those moments, those that happen in wrestling, and they only happen in wrestling because of wrestlers. And that's not to put down, you know, writers or anything like that. I mean, you know, I'm sure that, you know, writers are a creative part of the process. But really, it's the wrestler's business, and it's the wrestler who's responsible. And if the wrestlers don't, so many of the wrestlers, unfortunately, nowadays, look at it, they the term fired. How can you get fired? Well, you never really have a job. You know, Vince tells everybody, you'd be given an opportunity. And I swear to God, he's, you know, when I used to listen to him in the, you know, meetings saying stuff like, I'm like, you're so full of shit. But he's telling the truth. You're just simply getting an opportunity. Every time you go to the ring, you have an opportunity. It's, you know, you know, so how could you get fired? How can you get fired from an opportunity? It's impossible. And these guys are, you know, playing it safe. And I did the same thing. You go out there and you play it safe and you do what you're told and, you know, not what you think or what you feel in your gut. Because you don't want any heat. You don't want to cause any problems, and heaven forbid you get fired, you know? But that never gives you the chance to take advantage of the amazing opportunity that you really have.
Well, now the job squad, this was a behind the scenes, this was a backstage thing with the boys. Whose idea was it to take that idea from behind the curtain and bring it out front? Whose idea was that?
Vince Russo. Vince Russo, you know, really loved the T-shirts and the idea of it, and, you know, wanted to put it in front of the audience and stuff. All the underdogs banding together, so to speak.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I am actually in need of a new Job Squad shirt. Mine's pretty worn and ragged.
Well, for everybody out there, I'm starting to make them again, so the Job Squad always continues to live on, so.
That's what I'm trying to get at, Al. Let's plug the shirts. How are people gonna be able to get a hold of those things?
Well, I'll be in Chicago at the Wizard World Convention Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday this week. and I'll have the shirts there, and I'll have them, of course, at shows. And then here in the near future, I'm going to start up another Job Squad website, because it was really popular before I went to WWE, and start selling the uniforms of the Job Squad yet again. So, and you don't have to be a wrestler to be part of the Job Squad. You just have to be, you know, one of those guys that feels like he's been jobbed out. You know, that, you know, the one motto I always say is that, you know, other people have even quoted, and that is that, you know, pin me, pay me.
There you go.
Kissing ass isn't part of our JLB description.
Is that your favorite saying that's been on the back of the shirts?
Pin me, pay me, yeah.
Yeah.
That pretty much sums it up. You know, you can pretty much, you can say whatever you want. And, you know, the Job Squad was started out as a joke. It was about a lot of guys, because a lot of guys thought, you know, they were really winning. And, you know, they kind of forget, they kind of forgot why it is that we really shake each other's hand. And the reason we really shake each other's hands is because we really all need each other. Nobody can be anything or do anything in this business by themselves. You know, you can't be the main event without the opening match. And so you should thank the opening match. And you can't be the opening match without the main event. And so you should thank the opening, you know, the main event. And, you know, and everything in between. You can't be a winner if one, you know, another guy is not willing to put you over or to lose, you know. You know, so your idea that now you're a star and that you're now bigger than everybody else in the locker room is just a crock. Don't fool yourself, you know. You know, I always joke that the most powerful guy in wrestling at that time was Barry Horowitz. And everybody's like, well, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, I would say, you know, Undertaker goes out there and tombstones Barry, and Barry gets up and dusts his hair off and walks out. Well, who had the most power in that match? You know?
There you go.
You know, so, you know, it's not, you know, wrestling's not, you know, a lot of guys like to think when they're on top that it's, you know, it's, I always laugh because it's, you know, it's real when I win and it's fake when I lose. You know, that's the attitude these guys have. And, you know, brother, it ain't real no matter what. It's a work, and we're working the audience. We're not working each other. We're not trying, you know, we're not marks unless you're a mark for yourself. And, you know, don't buy into your own BS. Don't believe, you know, you got to have a portion of you that believes so that when you go to the ring, the audience believes, but not to the point where you're in the back trying to get us to believe it too. I mean, pump the brakes. You ain't all that. You know, yeah, you're the guy that, you know, we're all trying to put over right now. We're all trying to put you over so that we can all draw money, because if we don't put you over, because for some reason, just lightning in a bottle, you're the thing that's drawing money right now. So we're going to do everything we can to help you draw money, because guess what? The more money you draw, the more money we all make, dummy. Not just you. The rest of us make money too. So why, you know, would we not do everything we could to put over Steve Austin? Gee, many Christmas, that'd be stupid. That'd be bad business. So we're going to do everything we can to put Steve Austin over. Not just Steve Austin's going to do everything he can to get over. Everybody in the locker room is going to do everything they can to put him over. And so that means that, you know, Steve ain't a star by himself. Do you understand? Steve's a star. Rock's a star. But they ain't stars by themselves, because it takes the rest of the locker room to be willing to put them over to get them to be stars. And they should always say thank you.
So, are you still training guys at all? Or?
I go around and do seminars on the independents, which have been a lot of fun. But I don't have an actual school right now. You know, down the road in the future, I believe I'll probably open up another school and start training people again. I enjoy it, and you know, I think that, you know, I really believe it's my way of giving back to the business that has allowed me to support my family for 26 years, and you know, hopefully, you know, reacquaint people with, you know, the younger talent with things that really matter, that are really important, and because I really believe that there are certain things, certain aspects of the wrestling business that have always been there. You know, you're not reinventing the wheel; it's already round and it rolls just fine. And I think the more that people try to stop reinventing the wheel, the better it'll do, the more it'll roll. And, you know, I think that, you know, it gives me a chance to help pass along, you know, stuff that needs to be passed along, because if it's not passed along, and the talent these days don't know it, then, you know, it's going to, then the wrestling business is going to change. And when it changes, it's going to cease to exist. It's going to go away. Boy, wouldn't that be a shame? You know, would be,
it would suck.
Other than jazz, the one actual true American art form other than jazz, because wrestling is an art form, the one other true American art form other than jazz now ceases to exist because those people within the very business itself don't care enough to pass it on to the next generation. So, you know, when I train guys and, you know, run a school, it's my chance to get back to the business by making sure they really know things like what we've talked about here. You know, it sounds silly, but, you know, it's so important that, you know, the young talent these days don't focus on showing up at the building and having the best match on the show, but showing up at the building and having the match that sells the most tickets. That's a big, big, big difference. It's a night and day difference in thought process that no longer exists and, you know, needs to be.
Now, I put you in, I categorize you in a group with others. There's Jesse Hernandez in Southern California who's teaching his students properly. There's Michael Modest, who has done a lot of training up here in Northern California. There's Buddy Wayne up in Seattle area, where there are guys that are teaching the business properly. And I think that it's very important at this point in time that guys learn correctly, because very soon I have the feeling that the territorial system will be coming back, but in a limited, more of a limited capacity. Where the
territorial system could always come back. It you know why the territories went away? It's because we have a saying in business: you can put a pair of boots and a pair of trunks on anybody and call them a wrestler. You can't always put a pair of boots and a pair of trunks on somebody and call them a worker. And unfortunately, you know, Vince took all the workers, and that's why he made all the money, because his locker room was full of workers, and the territories were left with wrestlers. You know, guys that were talented, and that, you know, that's not a disparagement on any of them. They were all very talented. They just didn't have the seasoning or the polish or the real experience, the understanding of what it was that they were really trying to do.
They'd be with Vince.
And it's gotten worse. You know, there are tons of heads. There are tons of bodies out there, tons of bodies, but there are no heads. And if there were more guys who dedicated themselves to selling tickets and not having the best match, you'd have more places running shows. Think about it. Your local independent promoter runs a show. Every guy on the card, if you go ask him, do a poll, 10 matches, 10 out of 10 matches, all the guys will say, I showed up tonight to have the best match on the show. I was going to steal the show. Not a one will say anything about selling tickets. Now, if they all showed up to sell the most tickets and they now dedicated themselves to do that, your independent promoter's running Town A, and Town A starts drawing money. Oh, son of a bitch. He starts selling tickets, and the building's no longer big enough, so he now's got to get a bigger building. Well, now he's making enough money to where he can run Town B. He starts running Town A and Town B, and because the wrestlers are now more worried about selling tickets and making money than they are on just having what a fan on a website considers the best match possible, now they have more fans showing up at the building and therefore more money that the promoter can now reinvest and run A, B, and now C. So now they're working three times a month. They're now getting three times the experience. Not to mention there are other promoters that now realize these guys can wrestle, can actually work and draw money. And so they start booking them. So now the guys start working more and getting even more experience in front of a live audience, drawing money, not wrestling, working. And they continue to do so, and they continue to get more work. And then next thing you know, shazam, we start having guys running almost like a territory, where they're running two or three shows a week every month and then building from there. You know, that's how I ran it here in OVW when we were running the developmental system. And we ran 186 shows last year. 186 shows. Where else in the United States, what other company ran 186 shows? And they had, we had an average attendance of about 3,000, 3,500 people a month, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is when you consider that after a year's time, it was almost 50,000 people that these guys got experience in front of on a weekly basis for a year.
What's the interesting number, Al, is the people that were counted there that are repeat offenders. The repeat business is important.
Absolutely.
Any idiot can go out there and pop a 2,000-person house, but it takes a real good promoter to draw 1,500 every month.
Well, and it grew. It was continuing to grow, you understand? And, you know, people, you know, don't fool yourselves, you know, anybody that's listening independently, listening and go, oh, well, that's because you guys had TV. Yeah, we did have TV, and that does play a factor. But, you know, the most important form of advertising that even Hollywood kills for and Madison Avenue – and Fortune 500 companies kill for, it's called word of mouth. There's nothing that stops word of mouth. If you have 20 people show up at your show and you do everything you can to make them pay to see you again, not only will they pay to see you, but they'll go tell all their friends and family, and you'll probably get 10 or 15 more. Now you've got 35 the next month. And 35 people, you do everything you can to convince them to come back and pay to see you again. And they leave out of there on an emotional high, and they go tell more people. And now those 35 people bring in 10 or 15 more, and now you're working in front of 50 or 60. And, yeah, it doesn't sound like big numbers, but how do you think you eventually get to where you sell the whole building out? That's how you do it.
There you go. Now, what we're going to do is we're going – on my show, we're going to do we're going to test the Al Snow theory. The boys in the back, whether they're there to make money or to build things or to have a great match. July 5th, up here in San Francisco, Fog City will be debuting at the Kezar Auditorium.
Yeah.
I will be in the house, and what I am going to do is I'm going to go backstage. And I'm going to speak to 10 different guys and ask them that question.
Just ask them, did you show up tonight to have the best match on the show? And watch how many of them tell you yes.
And I'm going to give honest numbers. On
Tuesday,
July 8th, on my show, I will give honest numbers, and I will solidify the Al Snow theory.
It's not a theory. It's not a subject. This is not subjective. It's not subjective to my opinion. Okay? I can tell you directly from my conversations from all over North America, from Canada to, you know, I was just in Edmonton and asked guys, all those guys there, how many of you showed up to have the best match on the show? Every hand went up. I went to, you know, Bridgeport, Connecticut. And a couple guys asked me, you know, what did you think of my match, blah, blah, blah. I got into the same discussion, and I said, okay, guys, did you show up here to have the best match on the show? Uh-huh, yeah, sure did. I was in South Carolina, asked guys there, how many of you showed up here to have the best match on the show? Every hand went up. I was out in California. How many of you wanted to have the best match on the show? Every hand went up. I was here in Kentucky. How many of you wanted to have the best match on the show? Every hand went up. Go to Ring of Honor.
Yeah.
How many of you had the best match on the show? Every hand went up. Do you understand? I mean, it's not a theory. That is the prevalent in WWE, Ring of Honor, TNA, every independent promotion. Every guy out there now wants to have the best match on the show. And having the best match on the show ain't the match that necessarily sells the most tickets.
There you go. But like I said, the July 5th, I will ask 10 random guys in the back,
yep, please
and
do.
I will come on the show on the 8th, and I will give honest answers. I'm not going to tell you who am I speaking to, or
listeners don't
need to know that.
Yeah.
That's not important. I just want to see.
It's not a discouragement again on them either. It's just a lack of an understanding of what it is that they're really supposed to be out there trying to do, their job.
There you go.
You understand? A wrestler's job is not to have a great match. A professional wrestler's job is not to entertain you, the audience. A professional wrestler's job is to convince you to part with your money to see him as many times as possible. That's a professional wrestler's job. If he doesn't do that job, then why don't I just go put a pair of boots and a pair of trunks on a on another athlete and just have him go out there and do it.
Very good point.
I could ask guys that are out there listening right now, because most of the guys probably did the same thing. You guys probably watched tapes and you wrestled in your backyard before you ever got in the ring. You probably were doing moves that you now do in the ring. And there are kids out there that are doing it right now. Not that I condone it, because that's probably not the smartest thing to do. But everybody that's listening, what separates you from that 16-year-old kid that can probably do all your moves and probably physically do them better than you? You name the move, and he can probably pull it off even better. I know what should separate you from him, but do you know what should separate you from him? And if you don't, that's what you're missing.
Through all of your travels,
yeah.
What professional wrestler captivated you as far as a storyteller in the ring?
Oh gosh, guys like Tommy Rich and Buzz Sawyer.
Why
God? Mm-hmm. You know, Tommy Rich really does not get the credit he's due. He's probably one of the greatest workers ever in the business. Bar none.
I agree.
He was the first national babyface. You know, he could have been Hulk Hogan if he could have kept his own, you know, demons under control. You know, he was that good. But not only was he that good, but a babyface, he could go and turn himself heel and could be even and get so much heat as a heel. Ricky Morton, you know, incredible babyface, but also an amazing heel. You know, Jerry Lawler. The more I'm in this business, the longer I've been around, the more I come to appreciate just how amazingly talented Jerry Lawler is. You know, think about this. You know, Jerry Lawler was the go-to guy in WWE. Whenever Vince needs somebody to work with and to get him over or whatever, who does he turn to? Jerry Lawler. Or they get some heat, Jerry Lawler. And not to mention, think to put this in perspective, back in the day, okay, this was the way that the business used to work when you were in the territories. So you had your run in the territory, and then you left. You moved. You went to another territory. You had your run. That was it. You were done. Jerry Lawler stayed in Memphis for years. And not just stayed there and wore out his welcome. He stayed there and continued to be a draw. And guys like him and Bill Dundee, who never gets mentioned, or Dutch Mantel, those guys were able to sell out the Memphis Coliseum not once a month, every single week. For I think it was like 4 or 5 years they sold out that Memphis Coliseum every week. You must know what you're doing to be able to keep yourself. Yeah, think about that. Ole and Gene Anderson, as much as at one point I despised that, you know, bitter prick, Ole Anderson bought a house in North Carolina, in Charlotte. You never bought a house back in those days and stayed in the same territory. And he was a heel that continually got heat and that continually people paid to see get beat. I mean, think about it. And they you know, and trust me, promoters are not charitable people. If you don't draw, if you don't sell tickets, then, you know, especially back then, you didn't draw. You didn't either draw money or be the reason that their money was being drawn, or you didn't help draw the money, be of assistance to draw the money. You didn't get to work. You went away. They couldn't afford to keep you. And the rest of the boys didn't want you to, because it wasn't like they were going to go off and do something else for a living. That was all they could do to feed their families. So, you know, they did everything they could to put asses in the seats. And think about, you know, guys like Jerry Lawler, you know, Tommy Rich, you know, Bruno Sammartino, he doesn't get near the credit either. Selling out places left and right, you know? I mean, man, these guys, Dusty Rhodes, how charismatic. And was he a great technical wrestler, you know? A name that doesn't get really mentioned that, you know, and probably wasn't a really great heel because he got more over as a baby. You know, he'd get over as a baby face, but could get heat. And that kind of Rock patterned himself after. And that's Austin Idol. Iron Mike McCord. You know? I mean, the original Sheik. The original Sheik was so believable that after I had been in the business for probably 3 or 4 years, I still was scared of him when he came in the locker room. You know, he was not the biggest guy in the world, but when he came in the arena, people panicked because he was so believable. You didn't doubt. You didn't question, you know. Let's face facts. Would you say the original Sheik was
the greatest heel ever?
I don't know if he was the greatest heel ever, but he was an amazing heel, that's for sure.
Yeah.
He was a believable heel. He was scary, you know. And that's why people paid to see him, because they were really scared of him, and they wanted to see the babyface beat him, because he was scary. You know, let's face facts. I mean, let's not be stupid, because there are a lot of stupid people who think they know a lot about the wrestling business that they really don't, including the wrestlers. When's the last time that people actually believed that wrestling was real? And then what I mean by real is a competitive situation. I'll tell you when. That was back when the newspapers were covering it as an actual sporting event. That was probably, I think, 1928 or 30, somewhere in that range. So Vince McMahon didn't smarten everybody up. Everybody was already smartened up, but everybody still continued to show up because they wanted to believe. It's just like you going to see a movie or watching Chris Angel on TV. You don't really think he's doing magic, but you want to believe so you can be entertained. And wrestling's the same damn thing and has been for probably 50 or 60 years. But you could believe and you could buy into a guy like Jerry Lawler or Tommy Rich or Dusty Rhodes or Wrestling 2, Mr. Wrestling 2, or, you know, Ole Anderson. How believable is that guy? Robert Gibson, Austin Idol. I could go on down the list of, you know, Terry Funk, Harley Race. That they're so believable. What I mean by so believable is that it was easy. It made it easy for you while you were there to believe. And even at some nights, leave the building kind of questioning, kind of doubting, wondering. Well, man, I know it's not real, but goddamn, those two guys, I think they were trying to kill each other. You know what I mean? And, God, how much talent does it take to get people that are smart to, you know, they were smart. Everybody knew it was not a competitive situation. That's really what you're trying to work them on. You're not trying to work them on anything else. You're trying to work them into believing that winning and losing really matter. And everybody knew it, but it didn't, because it wasn't covered like baseball or boxing or football or basketball. It wasn't treated like that because it wasn't. It wasn't those things. So they all knew that, but they all still showed up. They all wanted to believe.
Well, you mentioned Tommy Rich and Buzz Sawyer. Now,
yeah.
Buzz Sawyer was Tommy Rich's foil.
Yes.
Who, in your career, who was your foil? That one guy that just kept sticking it to you, and you could never just finish it.
It was probably Sabu there for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
We had a really, you know, for had a really long run that I think kind of helped put both of us on the map. But it really helped me, you know, at the time, because for years I was known as the best kept secret in wrestling, you know, that's a compliment for a while, but then, you know, after a while it's like, hey, let's go tell the secret. And, we had that first match, completely by accident, on a show for this guy named Joe Lake, who booked a bunch of guys and of course didn't have the money to pay any of them. Sabu's opponent didn't show up that night. I'd already worked against Dan Severn in a pro wrestling style match as Shinobi to kind of help carry him through and help him have a good match. And, you know, was under a mask. And, you know, Phyllis Lee, God love her, suggested to Sabu that, you know, he didn't have an opponent. Why not work with me? And so I was like, I don't want to make him work twice, especially, you know, we're not getting paid. And I said, look, I just love to work. I'll work with you. And we went and worked, and that was it. You know, all of a sudden now, wow, where's he been? And, you know, got me noticed, and then we were attached at the hip. You know, we were kind of married for a long time. A lot of people wanted to book the two of us against each other.
Well, you and Sabu, I don't remember what belt it was for, but you guys had a ladder match.
Yes.
Any stories of that match? That match was so ahead of its time.
The one thing I can remember is that, you know, we had like a 16-foot ladder, and the thing weighed a ton. And I'm like, why do we have a 16-foot ladder? And, you know, Sabu's remark was, you know, because Jay just had a ladder match with Sean and Razor Ramon. And he was like, well, they had this great match with an 8-foot ladder, so, you know, we should be able to do even better with a 16-foot one. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, you can't really argue with that logic. So,
yeah, that was fun stuff. I think that match was one of the turning points where you started to really get recognized. Where was that match? Was it in Michigan or was it in Ohio?
It was somewhere in Michigan. I forget where it was in Michigan, but it was somewhere it was a suburb of Detroit. And, you know, Sabu asked me if I'd do the ladder match. I was like, sure, yeah, why not? And, you know, I was always up for anything. So, you know, one of the things that, as far as Sabu and I were concerned, the biggest compliment I ever got was a fan came up and was like, you know, you guys, you know, I know it's not, but boy, when you guys were in there, it seems like it's so real. It's like, you know, you really want to beat each other. And that was such a compliment, you know. Such a compliment that somebody would come up and say something like that.
I have to agree. I mean, that's about as good as it gets. You know, I mean, well, you know, when a fan, you know, just completely sets stuff aside and says, hey, man, you know, thank you. You entertained me. It was well worth my $25 that I plopped down.
Oh, yeah. Or God, I, you know, the when they come up and they go, gosh, you know, I still remember this and I still remember that. That tells me that I really, you know, I did my job. I did something that, you know, created a memory for them that, you know, that they still remember. And there's no bigger compliment than that. You know, that could have been the worst match I ever had. But for some reason, you know, it just stands out to them and they never forget it. You know, like so many people come up and talk to me about, you know, having the European title and that run. Had the European title, and I did a lot of goofy stuff. And at the time, I was like, "Oh, gee whiz, you know, this kind of sucks. You know, making a fool out of me." Not even realizing that, you know, people loved it, and still to this day come up and go, "Oh yeah, I remember when you brought this out, brought that out, and you know, you represent Transylvania, and still, you know, talk about it." So, you know, that was an opportunity for me. You know, that was a chance. That allowed me to, you know, however many years later, people still remember it and come up and talk to me about it. So, can't thank, you know, Vince enough for that.
Well, can you pinpoint or put your finger on your favorite match that you've ever had with Sabu?
No, not right. And you know the last one, I'd say the last we had a match in TNA, and it was a couple years ago. It wasn't in TNA, but it was a show that was ran by Hermie Sadler, and he and I wrestled. You know, a lot of TNA guys on it. I wasn't actually in TNA. I want to try and correct that, but I, you know, it was. TNA affiliate, I guess you could say, type Joe, because, you know, Hermie was tight with Jeff Jarrett at the time. And I got, you know, and Sabu was kind of tied in with TNA at the time, and I got to work with him. And, man, it was like a night off. I mean, we did some, you know, some crazy stuff. You know, it was kind of like a hardcore type match, but, man, it was so easy. And even he said, you know, he'd forgotten how easy it was to work with me. And, you know, and I'd kind of forgotten how easy it was to work with him, you know, just, you know. And then before that, we had a match for this independent promoter named Frank Goodman in New York, and same thing. I mean, it was just like, you know, it was like I've been working every night, 7 nights a week, you know, with each other. It was right there. So, and, that, you know, we were able to get the crowd on their feet on for anybody who's been to a Frank Goodman show knows we were like match 18.
Stand
we didn't go. Yeah, we didn't go to the ring until 11:30, 12 o'clock, which meant that, you know, short of a death or somebody committing Harry Carey in the ring, they'd seen everything. They'd, you know, but they could have sacrificed an animal on a pit of fire in the ring or you know, a virgin, and that would have been the only thing they hadn't seen before you walk out there at midnight to have your match. And we were able to keep those people and get them, you know, on their feet, and that was a bigger compliment to both of us than anything else anybody could ever say.
Now, this was in New York, correct? Before he moved to Florida? Okay.
Yeah.
Have before, you had a chance to work for Frank since he's moved to Florida?
No, huh? No.
Okay.
Have not.
Cool. I don't understand why he would try to run in Florida. Florida, just for some reason, it just doesn't get hot, you know, as far as the business is concerned. And, you know, he did rather well in New York, you know, and his product was always fun to watch. What do you think of Frank as a promoter and as a guy? And also, have you ever worked with him?
I've never worked with him in the ring. I mean, I've never worked with him in the ring. And, you know, as a promoter, I mean, he's definitely a quandary. I mean, you know, you show up and he would pay you. But, you know, and then he'd have a speech about respecting the business and then go out in the ring after he's walked around with a, you know, his long ponytail and then put on a mask and then with his long ponytail hanging out and expecting people not to know who he is. And you know, he would then shove hot dogs up a guy's butt in the ring. But he'd have a speech about, you know, respecting business. And then, you know, you'd show up and he'd always pay you. But then, you know, he one time called me and, you know, basically told me, well, you know, it's been a while, you know, they're taking longer to build my house down here in Florida and I've got bills to pay and I run these shows to make money. And if I don't have you on the show, then I'll make more money. And I'm like, well, are you canceling the show? No. Well, Frank, could you please make sure you call me and let me, you know, please let me know, are you going to cancel me off the show? Because there, I could go work these other shows, but I gave you my word that I would work your show. Well, I'll get back with you. Of course, never calls me. And, of course, continues to advertise me. And, of course, I then, you know, don't take the other show, but now I don't work on that day because Frank took me off the show because he just simply didn't want to pay me. And, you know, but continued to advertise me to the point to where people showed up and were like, hey, at the show the next night that I did get to work, and were like, where were you last night? I'm like, well, Frank told me, you know, didn't book me. Or unbooked me, and well, he acted like he was still there. So, you know, go figure.
Sounds like a pain in the ass, but you know,
you can't win them all, and probably just, you know, Frank's not necessarily the best businessman, I guess you could say, after doing things like that, or at least for that time he wasn't, and so therefore I really don't do business with him anymore. So, you know. I like to try and do good business, and I live by the motto that if you treat me good, I'll do everything I can to treat you better. If you you treat me bad, I'm going to do everything I can to treat you worse. You know, or just not, you know, and then, you know, in some cases, I'm just not going to deal with you at all. But in most cases, if you piss me off, then I'm going to make you my personal hobby, and I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that, you know, you pay some sort of price that's commensurate with whatever price I had to pay because of you being an idiot. So.
So out of all the students that you've trained and I mean we have the Tough Enough Kids, we've got the Blue Meanie, which I know they're all your children.
They're not
my
children. No. That's a big mistake. I love these interviews because it gives me a chance to clear things up.
Awesome.
They're not my kids. They're not my children. The kids, calling them my kids, that's an old wrestling term.
Okay.
And again, that's a lot of people think they know what it is, but they don't know what it is. Being somebody's kid meant that you were responsible for them. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that they're your father. The guy who trained me, I'm Jim Lancaster's kid. that doesn't mean that he is my dad. It doesn't mean I'm his child. It means that back in the day, protecting the business, the term protecting business, not a misused term nowadays, they think protecting the business means not smarting people up. It couldn't be anything further from that, because we've already established that the last time anybody was not smart to the business, probably 1932. Protecting the business was not just letting any Tom, Dick, or Harry get in the thing. Because it only takes one guy to kill the business or kill the town that you've been working and building up so that you could draw money. So it takes one moron to go out there and ruin it. So you were held personally accountable for who you brought into the business. And if that guy screwed it up, then he also screwed it up for you, and he affected how you fed your family. So that they were referred to as your kid. To this day, I'll be 45 next month, and Jim Lancaster, who trained me 26 years ago, still gets phone calls from other guys, other veterans and old-timers, who'll call up and go, hey, did you see what on the internet, on that internet thing, you know, what your kid said, or did you see your kid on Tough Enough, or did you see your kid do that stupid thing on TV? Guess who gets a phone call? I do, because until I get out of this business, I'm still a reflection on him. So therefore, I'm still his kid. And the kids in Tough Enough and anybody else I train are my kids, meaning that I'm going to do everything I can to ensure that they succeed and are the best they can possibly be in addition-wise to this business, because they're a reflection on me. And I don't want them to ruin my reputation that I've spent 26 years building or affect my way of making a living. So I'm going to do everything that I can to make sure they know what they're doing. They're my kids, not my children. My kids. That makes sense?
Makes all the sense in the world. Now, I know that you're as much proud as for each of your kids. I understand.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Has it surprised you that not as many have gone on to quote unquote stardom in the business?
What do you consider to be a star? I mean, Blue Meanie was part of a huge thing with the BWO and ECW, and very incredibly, immensely popular, and was then in WWE. I mean, Maven went from complete obscurity and never having a match in front of people to having his very first match on Raw, and had all the tools if he just continued, you know, kept his demons in check. And been a little more mature, would continue to have developed and eventually would have been a major, major, major star in professional wrestling. You gotta understand, man, being an NFL football player is pretty elite, isn't it? I mean, that's, you know, being in the major leagues of baseball is pretty elite. Being an NBA player is pretty elite thing to do, right? But how many teams are there in the NFL? And how many players are in each team? How many teams are there in Major League Baseball? How many players are in each baseball team? Okay. How many WWEs are there? And how many wrestlers are there in WWE?
That's a good point.
So
I don't even
what
know.
What do you consider a star? I mean, for Christ's sake, what's it take to impress you people? I mean, think about it. Seriously,
very
I mean,
point,
you know, what do you want? I mean, every single guy in the WWE is some kind of star. Because if you weren't, listen very carefully for you and all your listeners. Listen very carefully. 30 seconds of airtime. Cost $30,000. 1 minute of airtime costs $60,000. They give that guy a 1 minute promo. They give him a 1 minute vignette. They give him anything on that TV show. On a not a national, but an international TV show. Is that guy not a star?
Yes, he is.
I mean, for what do you want them to do? I mean, you know.
That's a very good point.
I could go, all those kids on Tough Enough were, you know, granted, it takes time to really realize potential of talent. It takes years. It takes years to learn this business of experience, of good and bad, to really get a grasp of it, to go to a certain level. But just because a guy's not in the main event does not mean he's not a star. Just because he's not in the middle of the card doesn't mean he's not a star. Those guys, all of those kids were stars. Dan Severn, major star in the UFC. I trained him for the UFC. I trained him for professional wrestling. He made it to WWE, major star. Held the NWA World Heavyweight title. Was he the best, you know, worker? No. But he was a star. You know, D'Lo Brown, I trained him. He's a star. He was, you know, you said yourself, in Japan. I go on down the list of guys who truly have advanced, you know, have been an asset to this business that I helped train. And I'm very proud of that. And, you know, they've all had different levels of success, especially guys on the major levels have all had different levels of success, but they've had all been very successful and have, you know, the biggest level of success is to be able to make a living and be able to feed your family by doing this business as your primary form of income. And I've got lots of guys that have been able to have been able to do that, you know. So, as far as am I disappointed that one or not, you know, not as many have been stars. I mean, again, you know, what's it going to take to impress you enough to consider them to be a star? Some of these people were in WWE, and you yourself said, how elite is an NFL player or baseball player? There's tons of base, and not saying anything against them, but how many football players are in the NFL? How many baseball players are in, you know, Major League Baseball? How many wrestlers are in WWE? And how many WWEs are there? There's only one. There's only one team, and how many players are on that team? So the lowest guy on the toe, Funaki, is a star, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, a few weeks ago I had Michael Modest on the show, and he said that a lot of the boys, they want the big time, the dance is the WWE. He says no. The dance for him is being able to go out there, make a living doing what he loves, and to be able to call himself a professional wrestler. That's my trade. And I see that you are in the same boat. Would you agree?
Absolutely. WWE is fantastic. I have nothing but good things to say about WWE. But WWE is not the be-all, end-all of the wrestling business. You're a worker. The idea, you'll always make money. You won't always make as much money as you would somewhere else, but you'll always make money. WWE is the place where you're going to make the most money, and you're going to get the most recognition, and you're going to have the most opportunity to truly have that commercial to make a name for yourself that's going to last well beyond your time in WWE. Case in point, myself. Think about Greg Valentine, Tito Santana, Randy Savage, Ricky Steamboat, George the Animal Steel. Those guys, they made their name for Vince back in the late 80s, and they still have a name to this day in the wrestling business. So working for the WWE is like the pinnacle. It's not the be-all, end-all. Being a wrestler, being able to make a living and doing what you love to do for a living and not have to do something else is truly the be-all, end-all. It doesn't matter to me if there's 500 or 5 or 5,000 or 50,000 or 500,000 people in that building. It just the sheer joy of getting out there and getting in the ring and getting the opportunity to do the thing that I would have cut off my right testicle to have gotten an opportunity to do 26 years ago and to still be able to get to do it. I can't say how blessed I am. Sounds corny. Sounds kind of, you know, foppish to say that kind of crap. But, you know, when you genuinely love what you do, then, you know, it's not corny. It really is. I mean, I can tell you right now, if I didn't genuinely love to do what I do, I wouldn't have been doing it for 26 years. I'd have found some other way to make a living. I'm more than intelligent enough. I could certainly do something else and make money, or more money, actually, than I would as a professional wrestler. But I do what I do because I absolutely have always loved it and will always love it.
Well, Al, I'm going to ask you the standard question that I ask all my guests. This is completely hypothetical. I am going to run an indie show and you a headline. And I could fly in whomever you would like to work with that is not under contract to any of the companies. Who would you like me to fly in to work with you in the main event?
Well, let me ask you something. If you're an indie promoter, and are you running that town on a monthly basis?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you're running the town on a monthly basis. Let me ask you, why would you want to fly somebody in to work with me? Why wouldn't you want to build and elevate one of your guys to look like they were on the same level as me, mm-hmm. so that he would be a draw against me, and so therefore, by working with me, we could do some kind of business to give that guy a rub to thus elevate him more, which would elevate the rest of your card.
Mm-hmm. Now,
why would you want to, why would you want to fly somebody else in?
I wouldn't have to fly in the guy. The gentleman that I was thinking of lives out here in the Bay Area, and that would be Michael Modest.
Uh-huh.
Mike is possibly the best independent heel I've ever seen. And
uh-huh.
I think that you as a babyface coming in to work with Mike as the heel would just... it would draw money. It would entertain my socks off, two of my personal favorites.
Uh-huh.
In other words, I was asking who would you like to come in, bring in to work with? Or would you prefer to keep it with a local guy?
I would suggest that if you're trying to do the right kind of business and build your town, that you would want me to come in and work with one of your guys.
There you go. There
that would
is.
Make more sense
I've
to
been
me.
Waiting months, I've been waiting months for someone to give me that answer.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it would make more sense to me to do that than it would to fly another guy in, because that then now, you know, what are you going to do next month? Fly two more guys
exactly.
in?
Exactly.
You're running a dead end street. So,
there
sure, and I'm sure a lot of other guys that you know that formerly worked for WWE, my peers or whatever, would be going, shut up, but. You know, business-wise, it just doesn't make good business for you, the promoter, to do something like that. So.
Awesome. Well, Mr. Snow, we've gone almost 2 hours.
Oh, my God.
My butt is sore from sitting under the learning tree. the fans out there, the listeners, I mean, I got workers that listen. I've got promoters, all kinds of different people listening. And once again, it was another trip under the learning tree. And I do this show for the younger kids so that are coming up so that they'll be able to, you know, learn the business properly. And
kind of like Sesame Street for wrestling.
There you go. Sesame Street for wrestling. That's it exactly. And, Mr. Snow, it was an honor to have you on my show today. And
well, thank you.
I greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. It was definitely a pleasure to get to be on the show and definitely a compliment that anybody would even consider me pertinent enough to listen to for 2 hours, for God's sake. What are you people thinking?
Tremendous.
Get a life.
So, if I do have a life, and I'm going to – actually, I have a wife, too, and she happens to say hello. You are her personal favorite pro wrestler.
Oh, thank you. All right.
What happened was we started dating, and I was watching Tough Enough, and she came in – and she saw it, and she's all, "Who's that guy?" I explained who you were, and she was hooked.
Well, thank God, because otherwise I wouldn't have a job. So.
There you go. Well, Mr. Snow, if anybody would like to contact you, promoter or whatnot, and would love to book you, maybe even a seminar, how would they go about doing that?
If they just they can email me at wwefrosty@aol.com.
There it is. Awesome. Well, Mr. Snow, thank you for your time once again. It was my pleasure. It was fun. We'll have to do this again.
Yeah. Just let me know.
Oh, before you go, what are you doing this weekend?
Actually, I'm going to be at the Wizard World Convention Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in Chicago, Illinois, at the convention center there. So if anybody's listening that happens to be in Chicago and you want to come out and say hi or want to ask a question, feel free. Come on up.
Tremendous. Tremendous. All righty, Al, once again, thanks, brother. I can't say thanks enough, man. You know,
Thank you.
You know, it's always a learning experience, and we'll definitely have to have you on again.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, brother. You have a nice evening, and thanks again for your time, Al.
Okay, take care, guys. Bye-bye.
All right, brother. Wow is all I have to say. I just went 2 hours with Al Snow. What more can I say? Unbelievable. I'm blown up. I can't wait to listen to this interview again. Well, let's run down the sponsors real quick. WrestleWarehouse.com, DVDs, Lucha DVDs, masks, SoCal Pro Wrestling DVDs. You need to pick up all the shows from this year. Adam Pearce is on fire. And before we get off the air, I'd like to put over both Adam Pearce and Scorpio Sky this past Saturday in Oceanside, San Diego, California. Pearce defended the NWA World Heavyweight title against Scorpio Sky, and from what I hear, they tore it down. So, Jeff, if you're listening, I need to get that footage as soon as possible. And our other sponsor would be FogCityWrestling.com. July 5th in San Francisco, they'll be debuting in a new building, the Kezar Pavilion. Jimmy Snuka and Nick Bockwinkel will be in the house for autographs. Rikishi's on the card. WWE developmental signee, newly signed Brian Cage, will be on the card. There's all kinds of guys. FogCityWrestling.com. And also, a quick plug, RFVideo.com. Rob, thank you for hooking me up with Al. It was definitely a pleasure and an amazing interview. Once again, thank you. You can get our archives of our shows at RubberGuardRadio.com or BlogTalkRadio.com/RubberGuardRadio. You can also hit us on MySpace, MySpace.com/RubberGuardRadio. Geez, hit me up. You know, if you're a fan, own a company, a worker, you know, whatever, you want to get on a show, hit me up with a message, or you can even email me directly, KidZombie2000@AOL.com. We'll be back on Thursday, June 26th, with Rob Feinstein for an hour at 7 o'clock, followed by Shane and Shannon, the Ballard Brothers, at 8. So we'll talk to you guys on Thursday.